My name is Eric Holm. I'm on staff here in the print shop. I'll be talking about landmines. A little bit as to how I got involved with it. I belong to an intentional community in Minneapolis, which has come to have a very strong presence at one of the primary landmine producers, which is based in a suburb, western suburb of Minneapolis. And, I got into it through that, and I've been active in the issue for about the last year and a half.
Hey, I'm Glenn Gersmell, and I'm the teaching staff, national coordinator of Lutheran Peace Fellowship, and I'm not at Holden. And I'll be covering the first and last parts of this. The first item. Oh, one other thing before I start. If there's anyone that would like to sort of keep up with the sorts of issues we'll be talking tonight, you'd be welcome to sign, put your name and address and phone and interests on this. Do it in kind of a block format, because ultimately we'll mail you a copy of the newsletter. The first thing is this Nobel Peace Laureate's Appeal. You should have a copy as you came in. Anyone not have it? As you can see from this, and I'll pass around some copies of slightly more detailed information, although the quality is so poor, I hesitate to even bring a pump. Keep that one that way, and perhaps you can start from the past that way, folks. Occasionally, there'll be efforts to get international figures to join together on various kinds of projects. And if you'll look in the bottom of the page, the signatories, so I want to just read the list because it's really quite impressive. Starting with Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela, the Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa, Mikhail Gorbachev, Aung San Suu Kyi, Shimon Peres, Yasser Arafat, Elie Wiesel, Reed Corrigan, McGuire, Adolfo Perez Esquivel, Desmond Tutu, UNICEF, Carlos F.X. Bello, Oscar Arias Sanchez, Frederick W. de Klerk, Norman Borlaug, Joseph Rotblat, Betty Williams, Lech Walesa, and Jose Ramos Horta.
Several of these people claim they almost never lend their names to such efforts, like Mother Teresa. I can't ever remember seeing her name on one of these sorts of efforts. And if you'll notice, the structure of it is focusing on children, focusing on the future, and proposing three things that are bulleted in the middle of the page. A decade for a culture of nonviolence, beginning with a year of education for nonviolence, and with a clarification or an amplification that nonviolence be taught at every level in our societies to make the children of the world aware of the real practical meanings and benefits of nonviolence and reduce lives, violence and suffering in the world. Let me throw out and just ask, what do you think of this? Is this a sort of a sidebar? Is this one of those little efforts that, hopefully with lots of other things will make something happen? Or does this have the potential of being significant? What are your feelings about that? Just your first reactions.
My first reaction is it feels late.
One of each month.
The year 2000. I mean, that the year of education for nonviolence wouldn't even start for 30 more years.
Right.
There's nothing about what to do today.
Right. I had exactly that feeling, and I think the hope is that the groups that are capable of performing that function would be gearing up and doing the work and doing workshops to help people prepare for that, and to so training people now to in turn be available to really make that first year a significant effort. But yeah, the idea of not starting until, it would have been really nice if they had done something that would have said what we do between now and then. Other reactions or questions or comments? What do you think of this? Is this interesting or worthy or noteworthy initiative?
Well, it's not loaded on any one end of the political spectrum, that's for sure. It covers everything.
Right. It's more than half of the Nobel laureates in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't see Henry Kissinger.
Yeah. I'll not comment.
I'm sorry, I missed it. Who got
He actually started? Has his own, or I will comment. He has his own organization. It's called Warmongers for Social Responsibility.
Who kind of got it started?
Just kidding. Good question. Let's see, who did initiate this? People that began it, I believe, were Perez Esquivel, Pierre Marchand, who's the IFOR delegate to UNESCO, and Merid Corrigan-McGuire. I believe that's who the letter first went out from.
Oh, okay. It's absolutely essential, wonderful, important, great, fantastic. Something that has to happen. But there's a lot of resistance to that violence, And I teach at a high school in North Central Illinois, and there's no way this would get through.
Huh.
Really, in my community.
All right. That was my experience for years, decades, that nonviolence was really marginalized. That if you talked about Gandhi, people's initial reaction was, that's pretty pie in the sky, that human beings are naturally violent. I mean, all of the various, defenses. And we... Lutheran Peace Fellowship, and actually starting before that, initiated an effort that was responding to the growing awareness of violence in our communities, to try to see if we couldn't naturalize the concepts of nonviolence. In other words, use to teach exactly what Martin Luther King and Gandhi and others had been saying, but to try to frame it in language that was easier for people to grasp. And in the end, we found that many times, just even a session 45 minutes long, by half hour the way through it, people, you would at that point present, someone like Gandhi or Martin Luther King, and people would say, that's really something we ought to look at. And I think the end of the Cold War and the rise of awareness of violence in our communities and on television and among kids, kids killing kids, largest single percentage of cause of death among kids is getting shot, at certain age levels, that we've got a really new ball game. And I believe more than ever than any other time in my life that this is actually possible. And with people of that clout and of that credibility fronting it, I think it's entirely possible that nonviolence could actually become a significant force again. But you're right. I think we're going against the grain in a certain way, and it takes, I think, some creativity to begin where people are and sort of gradually build up some of the kind of central structures and perspectives of nonviolence in order to be able to lay the groundwork for people to be able to hear the rest.
I'm not saying that it shouldn't be done or tried, or that it may not, that it might be, successful. It's
uh-huh.
Just, I'm also aware of how I don't know how to put it. Just the attitudes that I run into. I live in a very conservative part of the United States.
Right.
And but I think it also represents a large part of the United States.
So.
And it's one reason why I'm interested in leaving that area. Hmm. Because the attitudes are just so.
Right.
They're really, and there's a lot of formation around the military as far as being a really honorable way of living. And they're coming into the high school all the time, recruiting kids. And, you know.
Right.
And it's like, I'm the only teacher there that even questions that. Hmm. All the other teachers are just like, gung-ho, go into the military.
Right.
It's a great way of life, and it's going to help you achieve your goals.
I think there's court cases setting precedent that if the school allows the representatives of the armed forces in, then, for example, they need to also allow an alternative, like, what's CCCO stand for?
Central Committee
for Conscientious Objection. Mm-hmm. So then it sort of forces the school, well, either you do both,
right,
or you don't do it at all.
I mean, coming back, I mean, that's definitely an issue. And people, the level of understanding of nonviolence is very, very low. Many people, one of the distinctions I make is the distinction between not violent and nonviolence. Not violent simply, you know, like a reporter routinely will say it was a nonviolent demonstration. No, it was a not violent demonstration. A nonviolent demonstration, the single word, is one that adheres to the Gandhian principles of not engaging in any violence, but also not making the opponent an enemy. I mean, the whole nine yards of what Gandhi or Martin Luther King, right, or others talked about. And there's lots and lots of people that really have not a clue what that means. They imagine pacifism being passive rather than a whole different understanding of power, that it's not power over other people, but power with other people. That you seek to resolve a conflict that everybody wins, rather than the usual win-lose sorts of approaches. I mean, really a comprehensive different perspective on power. And one of the ways that we've found really open doors, and those of you that came this afternoon to the Wall of Hope discussion, was to tell the stories of not successes of nonviolence, going all the way to the most difficult questions that we've had to face, like, what would you do about Hitler? And to be able to present that if you looked at all of the countries of the world that were fighting Hitler at the time, many of the most successful efforts were in countries where they didn't take up arms against Hitler, where they used nonviolent strategies. Norway, the military leadership of the Nazi army were communicating back regularly to Germany saying, let's just get out of here. We're spending more energy trying to get the raw materials and the resources and the low-paid labor and so forth than we're getting back. It's a waste of energy to try to subdue this people. And those sorts of lessons people are ignorant of. And so one of our strategies has been to try to educate and just share the stories of the successes of nonviolence, to retell the stories of things like the Birmingham or the Montgomery bus boycott, or the Hebrew midwives, you know, who committed the first recorded act of civil disobedience,
oh, yeah, right,
when they refused to obey the Pharaoh's orders to kill the male Hebrew babies. And those going way back to those very, very early times, and sharing people, and people go, oh yeah, right. And building up an understanding of nonviolence by telling stories, rather than by engaging in a sort of an uneven theoretical discussion about that gets people, you know, defending the military. Don't even allow the conversation to move in a place where there's the assumption that we're somehow against the military. You know, it helps that I've got relatives in all four services and so forth. So that if it ever does come up, I just sort of cut it off by you know, hauling out my credentials, and then going back to talking about, and you know what? I can't tell you how many people who have served in the military, particularly those who are combat veterans, who have a real different perspective about the military and about war afterwards, or how civilian political leaders historically have been more willing to commit U.S. troops to battle than military advisors, particularly those that have seen combat. And just helping people like readjust a whole lot of little pieces of the puzzle rather than allowing the debate to be on grounds that we so easily, you know, get overwhelmed on. So but it's kind of trial and error or experimentation kind of process to try to figure out how to communicate nonviolence in a way where people can understand how it solves problems that we've got. I mean, I have a lot of credibility having worked a lot with kids, particularly in high crime areas. And I remember being on statewide, the Dakota News Network, both the Dakotas, 100 stations, broadcasting a drive time radio show. And I was paired up, they told me at the last minute, with a police officer. And so I just took it very slow, step by step, our experience with violence, and of course it's a lot greater than what's in the Dakotas, but it's going to be going there if they don't understand. We've got to help kids understand a totally different way of looking at power and different ways of resolving conflicts. I mean, the kind of images, and then take the places where the alternative is the weakest, like television violence, you know, where they see these time after time people using superior force rather than using their brains or using win-win kind of solutions, and heads are nodding all over it. Or, you know, the police officer was totally in support of the program because I had, you know, been thoughtful or careful about setting it up in a way that didn't sort of rub up against where he might not yet have figured it out, but started from where it's transparent we've got some problems with violence. You don't have to go to Bosnia. Go to our inner cities. Somebody from a 26,000 population town came up to me at the end of one of the sessions and says, yeah, we've really got this gang problem in our town. I'd really like to talk to you more about what you were saying about how gangs can be encouraged to like channel those energies into more productive ways and so forth. So I think with the credibility of these folks and with the and the notion of actually focusing on the nonviolence and all of the ramifications of a Gandhian or Martin Luther King kind of approach, that this is a tremendously important opportunity and one that it really would make sense for those of us that are involved in organizations that could facilitate it to be doing this kind of experiment.
I mean, is it up to LPF or some other organization to kind of pick up on this and then you provide some kind of curricula possibilities that... Is that the way it would have to work?
We and lots of people, and we're going to sort of move on to the next thing in a second, but when we come back to the Peacemaking the Congregation, I'll share some of the wealth of resources that are available on this. I mean, there's some really exciting resources on, including the one that I'll focus on that has a family or classroom pledge of nonviolence. In other words, it takes the theory of nonviolence, you know, up front as a way of approaching it. And so I think there's some resources already online that can help us do it.
Eric?
One of the concrete issues I'm going to talk about here is landmines. Now, I don't know, some of you I'm sure have been exposed to the controversy around landmines. Some of you may not have been. Can I just get an idea, show of hands, how many of you know something about where it's at? Great, looks like everyone. Well, that'll make our discussion much easier. Let me start off on a positive note. This is an issue I think we can do something about, and right now is the time to do something about it. There's been an international call for a ban for about the past 2 years. When did October of 95?
Yes, October 96 was when it sort of
came out in a concrete form. Let's achieve a ban by December of 97. So, but the call for a ban actually is even more longer than that. So okay. Yeah, you're right. It's been a while.
Well, 100 nations have been trying to find a way to put together a treaty that will place landmines in the ground of chemical weapons and ban them completely. So there will be no production, stockpiling, transfer, sale, etc. of anti-personnel landmines. The United States has been lagging, and in just last month they decided that they would endorse this ban, provided they could make a couple of exceptions. Their attitude has changed. Previously, the government was opposed to it, and now I think there's some progress being made. A lot of this is due to some organizations that have been taking a strong leadership role. Lutheran Peace Fellowship, Lutheran World Relief, the women of the ELCA have all played strong leadership roles in advocacy against landmines. In fact, Lutherans themselves have signed more petitions concerning landmines than any other denomination. So we're making some great strides, and this pact is going to be signed in Ottawa, Canada in December. So our support is it's crucial for where we are with this issue right now. We're about to move ahead, and I think we should be on it. So let's just talk a little bit about the kind of the basic facts, so we kind of have some can share some information. How many does anyone know how many mines are out there?
Too many.
Too many. That's right. Concretely. Okay. There are 110 million planted in 64 countries. 110 million. There's an equal amount sitting in stockpiles just waiting to be scattered or sowed or placed. Most of them are in the third world, in poor agricultural countries. They're planted in agricultural fields, crop fields, rice paddies, hillsides, wood piles. And as a result, most people who are injured by mines are civilians, not military personnel. Perhaps more often than not, the victims are civilians who encounter the mine long after a conflict has ended. In some cases, these civilians are women and children, and up to as many as about 30%. Worst of all, the mines, as I'm sure you all know, are not actually, in most cases, are not lethal. They're designed to maim, to injure, to demoralize, and they do. I have some slides that I can show very briefly so that we can kind of see what's going on with those.
Hold on,
screen. Yeah, Glenn, would you care if that's the screen? Personnel landmines. There are, I believe, upwards of 300 different kinds. This is actually just a small number of the different kinds. A little round object you see in the center forefront of the picture, that's called a blast mine. Those are the most typical mines that which are encountered. It is activated by stepping on it, so it's typically buried in the ground. Mostly made out of metal. Now I think they might be making them out of plastic. Other kinds are fragmentation mines, which leap into the air and then explode, scattering fragments in all directions.
The boot is for reference to size or something?
I'm sorry?
The boot, is that just for size reference?
Yeah, that'll give you, to give you an idea of about how big these things are. They're tiny. Little children in some of these countries often mistake them for toys.
One couple look like oranges.
Yeah. This is an example of the injuries that are caused. Some mind victims. Most, Glenn, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong on this. I believe most victims of landmines have to undergo amputation to varying degrees, above, below the knee. Here we have a small child being outfitted with an artificial leg. It's been estimated that a 10-year-old child over the course of his or her life will need perhaps 20-some artificial limbs, which can cost, for that one child, upwards of $3,000. This gives you an idea of the cost incurred by encountering the mines. And keep in mind that these are in third world countries. Usually these kids can only afford crutches for about $10. Lady and the crutches. I think that's it.
And then it affects their ability to do certain kinds of labor.
Exactly.
When you remember, these are third world countries where they don't have sidewalks very much, and where physical labor is much more important economically than it is here. The options are much less. It's
what fuels the use of these?
What fuels the use?
Why are they used so much?
Traditionally, they were used to direct, in a conventional conflict. They've been used to block enemy traffic, to secure certain areas. Glenn, maybe you can think of...
Channel opposing forces into so-called killing zones, you know, and just spread demoralization. I mean, you're sneaking through a forest, somebody hits a mine, it blows up, you know. Well, imagine yourself, you want to move forward at that point, not knowing if you're going to be the next one to step on something. So.
I think also within the last 20 years or so, we've seen an increase of the use of mines just simply as a terrorist weapon. They've been used to create refugee flows, to block access to food, in some cases, just simply to brutalize people.
And of course, you can do that fairly cheaply.
Right. Does anyone know how much it costs? How much mines cost to make?
About $3.
Between $3 and $30 to make. Does anyone know what it costs to remove them? costs about between 300 and 1,000 to take out that same $3 mine. Because, again, an idea of the polarity and cost.
Is the U.S. the biggest producer?
I don't know.
China,
Russia is also a big producer.
Italy is ahead of us in terms of Western nations. Germany, just about all of the industrialized nations have produced mines. We're not very high up on the list. Our problems lie elsewhere. That we've been emphasizing these so-called smart mines, and poor countries are, you'll get into poor countries that, yeah, sure, you're going to use those, but ban ours. No dice.
That's an important point that Glenn just brought up. The United States, part of the United States' reluctance to join this ban is based on its use of what are called smart mines. Typically, the way the mine works is that it's set to activate and it lies dormant until someone comes along, steps on, and it goes off. That can be a day, it can be a week, it might be a year, 10 years, in some cases, 50 years. Smart mines, on the other hand, are mines that are supposed to, they're programmed to deactivate it after a set period of time. So, in theory, they're safe. You put them in the ground, and once you know that you program it to go off after a certain period of time, and then you can leave the area and know that that the area is no longer mined. Problem is, what happens if a child or an innocent person comes along and steps on it before it's deactivated? That's been the basis for the United States reservation.
Yeah, even if it is, I'm just curious, if it deactivates itself, can someone then find a way to activate it again?
I don't know.
That's a threat, yeah. And one of the interesting things is that the Vietnam Veterans of America, one of the leading groups.
Yeah, we've had those phone calls.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And many, many military officers, including Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf, who led the U.S. forces in the Gulf War, are opposed to landmines. And part of their rationale is that it's demoralizing for troops because, they know how easily it can be that the army can screw up on something. And for military officers to say, okay, I'm going to stand back here, and you guys are going to go through that field because the mines are all smart mines and they've deactivated themselves. And, there'll be heads turning around saying, yeah, right. When was the last time the army ever did something that was 100% effective? I mean, they see it all the time, their equipment. And so, troops don't like landmines. They don't like that uncertainty of knowing, of being told to believe, it's going to be my foot that's going to be blown off. You go first if you feel so confident that all of those mines have deactivated themselves and they're that damn smart.
It's interesting, too. I saw a figure recently that 14% of the casualties in Vietnam were caused by landmines, American landmines.
Wow.
In fact, the army estimated that 90% of the mines in Vietnam were made by America or had United States components in them. I find that very interesting.
What about the anti-tank mines?
I don't know as much about those.
They're not covered in it.
Yeah.
It's the real problem is really these. I mean, you can step on one of those and it won't go off almost all the time. So the treaty is really designed to zero in on the problem.
And the anti-tank ones wouldn't be put in the sort of as much civilian workaday world places.
One of the biggest questions I think comes out of this kind of this talk is, we know the problem, what can we do about it? And so if we could just spend a little bit of time just talking about ways that we can take our concern out into our communities and to do some work against mines. One thing that we can do, hopefully you picked up on your way in, a copy of the worship resource published in the Lutheran Peace Fellowship newsletter last fall. That's one thing that you could use to plan a service, take some ideas off of it for some other activities in your congregation. Pray for victims, for relief and demining workers, and involve your congregation. There's always more education to do surrounding the issue, and there are Glenn's put together, I think we have copies of it by the door. We have a bibliography here of a variety of materials that you can use and request to help educate people on landmines. There's also the city of Chicago recently passed a resolution supporting the ban on mines. You might ask your church council to pass a similar resolution, and I do have a copy of that if anyone's interested in looking at it. There are, there's always direct contact of your legislator. As I said at the beginning, we are in the process of debating the ban to be, the treaty to be signed in December. Write to your congressperson, or better yet, give them a call. Let them know how you feel.
You know, I wonder if one of the ways you mentioned, for whatever reason, that Lutherans have seemed to be motivated to sign petitions and such things. And for example, I know that Lutherans are quite motivated in terms of world hunger issues and so forth. And then when they hear that the landmine problem causes terrible problems for food production, how do you go work in a field when there's landmines?
Right.
And then you've got people malnourished.
Right.
And I wonder if that might be one way which a bunch of Lutherans have said, oh, this is not just a military thing.
Right. That's a really interesting, that's an excellent angle too, because mines really do inhibit cultures or inhibit countries from fending for themselves. Acres and acres of land are rendered unusable by mines. You can't go in to farm. Unfortunately, they try anyway and suffer the consequences. The stories are all too common about children, small children going out into the field to fetch water, take the animals out, and landing in mines. Yeah.
Do you want to go on the next one so we can cover as many for them?
Okay. This one is going to be a kind of a quick and we'll answer questions that people want that could pass those down. The international arms trade is a really interesting issue. All through the Cold War, I would hear military people, when I would ask them, why are we supporting, Mobutu in Zaire or Marcos in the Philippines, they would say, well, no, they're pretty disgusting characters, but the Soviets are backing a regional rival of theirs, or they're despots, but there are despots. The end of the Cold War comes, and not only do we not reduce the amount of weapons we sell to these countries, we vastly expanded it, or significantly expanded it. Where we sold weapons to 60 or 70 or 50 countries per year during the Cold War. Each of the last 3 years, we've sold to more than 140 countries. Where we used to sell off old weapons, in part to make way for new weapons in the military, we're now selling our top-of-the-line weapons. Kuwait and Saudi Arabia accepted deliveries of more M1A2 tanks, the world's most modern main battle tank, than the U.S. Army. They had more numbers of them than we did. 16 countries manufactured parts for the entire plane of F-16s, which is one of our top-of-the-line fighters. And it goes on and on and on. This is an effort to try to pick one piece of this puzzle that could be widely acceptable and understandable to folks. The boomerang, that is, you sell weapons and those weapons come back and hardly, it's not a free ride. Every single time the United States has gone into combat since the end of the Cold War, we have faced U.S. weapons.
This is a gambling thing?
This is a gaming card, right. It's a scratch card. Maybe one person would like to scratch it off while we're talking here and pass around what it looks like, and that way you can take it home and use it in some fashion, unscratched. I'll leave that to your devices. But this is just one, I think, really creative effort to try to take the issue of the arms trade and open it up. If you're interested in more information about it, I'd be happy to share more. For example, the Wall Street Journal a year and a half ago ran a very superb front page article on the problems of the arms trade and really, I think, laid out effectively the negatives on economic grounds. So if the New York Times business section or the Wall Street Journal can both run articles basically supporting or a reduction in the arms trade, maybe there's something to it. And finally, like the worship resource, where the back of it is camera ready to make copies of a bulletin insert that's ready to use in the congregation, and therefore you'll reach everybody in the congregation, everybody that comes to worship, not just the 15 or 20 or so people that would come to adult forum. This is, I think these resources are ones that are capable of reaching out beyond the people that already believe that the military is, too heavily funded, or that, the world is too warlike or whatever. They're like landlines, there are military officers and others who are supporting us in this. So I'm happy to answer questions or talk further about it, but I wanted to at least lay out it's one of the more significant places where we can make a difference, even of people who like supported the Gulf War or have kids in the military or relatives or whatever. This is the kind of an issue that, U.S. troops, if you did a poll of any group, ask them, what do you think of the idea of other countries getting hold of our weapons? That's a real emotional issue. They do not want that to happen. And for us to be selling them at the rate we are and at the quality level we are is really ridiculous. I'll end with one more. I once talked to a middle-level person in the State Department, and I said, we were talking about the arms trade. He says, yeah, it's not really going to go anywhere. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. We were talking about selling arms to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Do you know, or do you know anyone in the upper levels of the State Department who would be willing to assure me that they know who is going to be in charge in Kuwait or Saudi Arabia in 10 years? And there was a laugh at the other end of the phone, a kind of nervous laugh of someone who says, that's an interesting point. We're selling weapons to countries that we have no idea in whose hands those are going to be. And there was a huge amount of weaponry that landed in the Shah of Iran's hands. I mean, who thinks Khomeini was a big improvement over that? Due to popular interest, we decided to add a domestic dimension to this whole. I'm going to pass out two resources. One is a one-page bibliography, very, very selective, as you can imagine, that lists some of the more interesting resources that are out there for congregations. Most of these attempt to deal with a range of of issues, not just interpersonal, but not just international either, but stressing peacemaking on the sort of family or community sorts of levels. Some of those are familiar, I'm sure. Others may be new. One of them is the third one down, Family Pledge of Nonviolence, and I'll be passing out a copy of this. This is one of the longest standing groups that's worked on these issues. It's the Institute for Peace and Justice. I've known about them for 20 years. They produced a book called Parenting for Peace and Justice that has been around for maybe 12 or 14 years. And now, for the last few years, they've been promoting a project called FAVAN, for short, Families Against Violence Advocacy Network. One of their resources is this very attractive, brief, well-illustrated booklet that's available for $5. There are copies over in the bookstore. I'll pass this one around. You can just sort of flip through. It's sort of the basic guide to it. They also have audio tapes. They have curricula for schools, etc. Their goal, I don't know if it's achievable, but their goal is 1 million signers by the end of the decade. And this would give a big shot in the arm if they're even anywhere close to that, to the Nobel laureate's appeal. You open it up, and it's along the lines of what I was saying in response to the question about, how easy is it for the average conservative community in the United States to deal with this stuff. Respecting ourselves and others, communicate better, listen, forgive, respect nature, play creatively, be courageous. This is fairly common sense and fairly straightforward, practical kind of an approach to what we're dealing with here. And to have a process that encourages people to sign and commit themselves to a particular course of action is a way of sort of pushing the issue a little bit and creating a climate where people are going to want to have the kind of training that they would need to be able to actually follow through on this.
How will they know how many have signed this?
Because you mail back the bottom little tear off. We have a longer list of roughly 4 pages, and then of course just acres of stuff. I mean, I've had teachers come to the resource center regularly and we'll pull out 30 or 40 different curriculum guides and resources from a selection of about 100 and pile them all on the table and sit there and go through them, and they had planned to leave in an hour and they're still there 2 hours later, and then they ask if they can borrow 15 of them and take them home and make copies of things and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of resources out there. This is a really very selective list. But it's a good thing, too. I mean, it suggests that, in fact, when a teacher or a worship leader or a youth leader comes and, peruses one of the places where you can take a look at this stuff, that they typically say, wow, there's just tremendously more available. Mm-hmm. Summer camps this past summer, were using a really quite well done resource on the theme of peacemaking. Women of the ELCA have a 3-year project on peacemaking. There's a couple articles, one by me and one by Jean Martinson, who's on our board, on that second chair there. The title is The Peace of the Whole World, and then mine is on the back. So, significant agencies in the church have been making efforts in that direction. The ELCA passed the social statement on peace called For Peace in God's World that explicitly encourages congregations to teach about nonviolence. So we've got a lot of the structural support that we need to for this to be done in the ELCA, and there are other denominations like Presbyterian Episcopal that are even further ahead of us. I mean, they've done even more dramatic things on a policy level that lay the groundwork for things to happen. Presbyterian Peace Fellowship has raised with their denomination in the neighborhood of $1 million a year for the last few years for peacemaking projects around the country and there and the world on within the Presbyterian Church, just to pick out one example. So there's really a lot of hope in the new you know, fellowship proposals, ecumenical proposals that were passed or that are going to be passed in the next few years, and denominations can, in terms of the kinds of things that are available. Some of you came last night to the program on media violence. This is the resource catalog of the largest and most effective of the groups that I know of on media violence. And just flip through it. I mean, it's really pretty impressive. They have these whole video series, and they have them age broken down. So you can have one for the kids, one for the teenagers, one for the adults. And there's a whole series of videos and handouts that you use. And if anybody wasn't there last night, that would like to just flip through and take a look at that. Very, very impressive. And in fact, is someone that was there last night want to just comment on what you thought of that program?
Comments?
Want to share what you thought? Just very, very effective video segments and so forth.
I thought it was excellent.
I had a pastor say in the Portland area that in 14 years of ministry, he had never had a program that was both as effective for his own people and that brought in really measurable numbers of other people from outside who would say, you know, I'm not Lutheran, but can I come to your program? I've heard about it. That kind of kudos speaks.
So is it a one night or several weeks or what?
Multi-week. There are different packages. The Beyond Blame page is probably the easiest way to get a sense of it. That's sort of their core program. But then they have all kinds of other resources that you can plug in. And I would very, very strongly urge you to bring these back. Take an extra copy of one of these if you'd like. Bring it back to the people in your congregation and in your community and in your schools that might be interested in doing something. In addition to the Family Pledge of Nonviolence, I have a few copies of the Classroom Pledge of Nonviolence. It would be something that you would take to your relative or neighbor or friend or member of your congregation who works in the classroom and might be interested in exploring the possibility of using that resource.
It's the hour, so I know I don't mean to be rude, but it's more polite for me to, you know, be asleep in my bed than to sleep here. I'm not really.
Okay, that's well put. Good place to end. There's a spectrum of some of the resources that have gone on other projects. LPF has a trip to Latin.